You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the post-9/11 backlash against immigrants continues under the shadow of the war on terror, the Coalition for the Human Rights of Immigrants has received information notifying them of a possible plan for mass deportation scheduled for this evening. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with David Wilson, who works closely with the group.
A source that we can't name, but who's been reliable in the past, told the Coalition for the Human Rights of Immigrants in New York that the U.S. government is planning a chartered flight to Amman and maybe other places in the Middle East tonight or early tomorrow morning with as many as 100 Middle Eastern detainees to, you know, take them back to their countries. That would probably be Jordan and the West Bank of Palestine.
And so what can you tell us? How much is known about who these 100 people are or if their families are aware of what is about to happen to them?
As far as we know, the U.S. government does not put out information about these. It's entirely through our sources that we know this, and we don't know who's going. Basically, families aren't told when these flights take place. Their loved ones simply disappear from the prison where they're being held in this country. And then maybe in a few days they'll hear from them in Amman or in Bethlehem or wherever they've turned up.
Do you have any information about what crimes these detainees may have committed that would justify the U.S. government, and I'm assuming this is under the Department of Homeland Security, deporting them in this surreptitious manner?
In fact, it is the Department of Homeland Security. It's the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is the enforcement arm of the INS, which is now in Homeland Security, and they are being deported under the immigration laws that existed long before 9/11. They are being deported because they have visa violations. They're being deported because they committed some crime in the United States, and they served their time here, but because they're foreigners, they can be deported under the 1996 law. I mean, basically, they're being deported because they are immigrants, and they don't have the same rights as citizens.
So overstaying a visa is not a crime?
Overstaying a visa is a violation, and it's considered a civil offense. So that if you, for instance, if you're in this situation of being deported, you can ask the government, well, are you going to give me a lawyer? And the government says, oh, no, you're not charged with a crime, so you don't get a free lawyer. It's a catch-22. They hold you in jail as if you were a major criminal, but they don't even pay for a lawyer for you.
So is this sort of deportation unprecedented?
It is not unprecedented. They actually had a Middle Eastern deportation on May 14th, in which they deported, we know of, 6 Palestinians to the West Bank, and we think some Palestinians also to the Gaza Strip through Egypt. Certainly these flights have been happening almost in a regular way with Pakistanis and with Filipinos, like flights with 100 or more people on them. I want to say that, you know, people are treated very badly on these flights. They're being kept in handcuffs and shackled, even though, as they say, they're not charged with crimes. They're simply immigrants who are being deported.
You, David Wilson, are with the Coalition for the Human Rights of Immigrants. What are you calling on listeners who may be concerned about this problem? What are you urging them to do?
We're asking them to call the BICE, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and demand that, number one, that people be treated properly if they're going to be taken on these flights, they not be shackled and so on. And we want to make sure that people who are taken on these flights do have adequate travel documents. And, you know, in other words, that they can actually, when they arrive at Amman or wherever, they have papers so that they can get, you know, settled into the society there, and they not be sent through hostile countries, or they'd be put in any situation where their life is in danger, which could happen with some people, for instance, in Jordan. And we're also asking the people who have complaints against the U.S. government, who have investigations going on, not be removed, because the government has a record of removing people who have suits and so on with the United States government, just removing them to a country thousands of miles away so that they'll have trouble pursuing it.
Is there a specific phone number that individuals should call to intervene for
yes,
tonight?
We're asking people to call David J. Venturella, and he is the head of the Office of Detention and Removal. His number is 202-514-8663. That's 202-514-8663.
David Wilson worked with the Coalition of the Human Rights of Immigrants. We reached him at the group's offices in New York. Unfortunately, the situation for Palestinian refugees isn't much better across the border to the north. Stefan Christoph of CKUT Radio offers this report on Palestinian refugees in Montreal and a campaign that's been launched to stop their deportation.
Currently in Montreal, there are over 100 Palestinian refugees who are facing deportation from Canada in the coming days, weeks, and months. Most of the refugees are from the refugee camps of Lebanon and from occupied Palestine. They have claimed refugee status in Canada over the last couple of years. Systematically, Palestinian refugee claims are being rejected by Immigration Canada post-September 11th. A campaign to stop the deportation of Palestinian refugees has been launched in Montreal to build concrete solidarity for Montreal's Palestinian refugees as they organize to fight against Citizenship and Immigration Canada's attempts to deport them to the illegal and deadly Israeli military occupation which plagues everyday life throughout occupied Palestine and to the violence, poverty, and persecution which defines life in the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon. I spoke with Bashar, a Palestinian refugee facing deportation, and Rabia Masri, an organizer with the Coalition Against the Deportation of Palestinian Refugees.
My name is Bashar. I'm a Palestinian refugee from Lebanon. I came here, I claimed refugee status in Canada, actually. And what we're facing now is this massive deportation, you can say, of like 100 Palestinians who are coming from the refugee camps of Lebanon or who are coming from the occupied territories. Those who have escaped all the humiliation and the non-humane conditions out of all the camps in Lebanon and came here for a decent life. So some of these people, like us, we are facing deportations right now. And we are having this demonstration just to say no to these deportations, to stop these deportations, and to raise this public awareness of what we're facing right now, what we're going to face when we go back where we came from.
There's millions of Palestinian refugees around the world who are facing persecution in various refugee camps in different countries. Why do you feel that these rejections on the part of Immigration Canada took place?
What we're facing here is mainly from the IRB commissioners is the lack of knowledge about the whole case, about the persecution of the Palestinians. They have some ignorance about the whole subject, actually. Although that the IRB and the Immigration Canada, they have tons of documents about the situation of the Palestinians, both in the refugee camps in Lebanon and in the occupied territories. And they know lots of things about it. The problem is these documents being read by IRB members or not? What we have seen that these judges who are dealing with the cases, actually, they have no idea what's going on, mostly. They are ridiculing the whole case, the whole persecution, most often on asking some silly questions. Not asking the main questions about the persecution these people are suffering, what they are running from. So this is the problem, I mean. Like, Palestinians in Lebanon, they live in these camps. Everything is messed, I mean. It's like blocks or cubes put above each other, you know. The sewage is everywhere, the trash, there's no infrastructure, the streets, no pavement, nothing. This is inside the camps. And in Lebanon, actually, Palestinians, they are not allowed to work in over 70 professions. They do not have medical or health care over there. Lots of persecution they are facing. The checkpoints on the entrance of the camps, like Palestinians have to be checked every time they enter, go in or go out. They are not allowed to bring in any construction material inside the camps. So, I mean, this whole situation, it is a persecution, I mean. We want our very basic human rights, nothing more, nothing less. This is what we're asking for. We're not asking for much. Why should I live in a society, live as a lesser human being, and make somebody tell me what to do, what not to do, what to work, what not to work, how to live, and where to live? I mean, this is unacceptable. In the future, I'm going to have a family. I'm going to have children. Why should they suffer? Why should they be refugees at a time? Why shouldn't they have the chance to live like any child in the world?
Can you speak about your experience as being a Palestinian refugee here in Montreal?
The first time we arrived to Canada, I mean the first month we live here until the hearing we had, we felt some freedom, in fact, to be honest. Yes, because we're not using this kind of freedom. At the very first point when we came here, the freedom to move around without anybody checking you out, without anybody asking you about your identity, you know, your right to have a job even, you know. These things we were missing, it means a lot for us, you know, this kind of freedom. Maybe people here are getting used on it, but for Palestinians, when they see very simple things, it really means a lot. Like one guy, when we first came here, he was asking, don't they have an army here in Canada? I say, why? Why are you saying so? He say, I don't see any checkpoints here and there. See, so the idea of people of the army is checkpoints. This is the way they lived their lives. They see, you know, every 10 meters or so, there's a checkpoint. So the idea of army is checkpoints all around the place. This guy was asking, I mean, you know, it's different, you know. They have a different feeling. I mean, the very basic thing of being Palestinian refugee, without considering any other thing, is the persecution itself, I mean. When you have a hearing for a Palestinian refugee, considering the very fact that he's a stateless Palestinian refugee, first and foremost, this means persecution, I mean, without discussing anything else, without discussing if somebody was pointing a gun into his head. This is persecution, I mean. Do I have to have a bullet in my head or a bullet inside of me that I'll be facing persecution?
Can you speak about the process that has been imposed on Palestinian refugees that have been rejected through Immigration Canada?
One example of that is the appeal process here, that there is no such thing as an appeal process. The appeal process is nothing but bureaucratic red tape. This is what it is. Unfortunately, this has caused a huge problem with the Palestinian refugees, because what it created is a situation in which one member of the Immigration Refugee Board, so one human being who probably is not well aware of the issues on the ground and might have prejudices regarding specific issues and specific individuals, decides the fate of other people, the refugees that are standing at the hearing. In this case, it's the Palestinian refugees. So there is no appeal process in Canada. There's a judicial review at the federal court. There's the pre-removal risk assessment, which in 99% of the cases are not even studied. So the actual file of the person is not seriously considered from start to end. So we want to deport the person as soon as they get to the hearing. And we constantly try to deport the person. Unless that person makes it practically impossible for us to deport, we're going to deport that person. So everybody is guilty until proven innocent. This is how the people are being treated. They're being treated as criminals. They're being treated as liars. They're being insulted at the hearings. And after that hearing, they don't have a second chance. That's it for them. Now, with regards to prejudices and ignorance and so on, well, obviously, in North America in general, and very much so in the West these days, when it comes to Arabs, Muslims, and even Palestinians more specifically, there is a lot of discrimination on all levels, whether it's through the media, whether it's through the political discourse of politicians, whether it's through the laws that are being passed by politicians post-September 11th. All of these have created an atmosphere that these very members of the Immigration Refugee Board are not immune to. So a lot of these members are certainly affected by this whole atmosphere and base some of their decisions solely on what they hear across the media or the political discourse and so on, and not in accordance to the facts that are on the ground, which they are very ignorant to. So you put all that together and you can see very much where the injustice is. And this is destroying the life of human beings who are looked at as simply files and dossiers and cases and numbers by these Immigration Refugee Board, by Immigration Canada. These are refugees that have always been used as political cards, be it in the refugee camps in Lebanon by politicians there, and then they come to Canada and they're treated again as simply cards and numbers and not looked at as human beings who are seeking protection and seeking a life.
You've been listening to an interview with Bashar, a Palestinian refugee facing deportation from Canada, and Rabia Masri, an organizer with the Coalition Against the Deportation of Palestinian Refugees, about the case of over 100 Palestinian refugees in Montreal, which Citizenship and Immigration Canada is attempting to deport back to the occupied territories and the Palestinian refugee camps throughout Lebanon. A campaign in Montreal has been launched to build support for the Palestinian refugees as they resist Citizenship and Immigration Canada's efforts to deport them.
That report from Stéphane Christophe of CKUT Radio in Montreal. Finally tonight, Michael Avery, the upcoming president of the National Lawyers Guild, offers his take on the Patriot Act, as well as the issue of enemy combatants and the executive order on military tribunals. He begins speaking of Yasser Hamdi, the American citizen charged as an enemy combatant.
He was somebody who was seized by the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. The allegations the Northern Alliance made were that he had a weapon at the time he was seized. He was handed over to the Americans. He was brought here. He was put in the naval brig in Norfolk. Finally, somebody in his family got a lawyer for him. They filed a habeas corpus action. It came to court. The district judge said, wait a minute. How do we know that he had a weapon? How do we know that he was fighting on behalf of the Taliban? I'd like to get a little more facts. I've got some questions I would like the government to have to answer. I've got an affidavit here from this man, Michael Mobbs, who says that this is all true. But Mr. Mobbs, by the way, doesn't even tell us in his affidavit who he is, exactly what his position is, or how he happens to know this. I'd like to get a little more information, and so the government has to answer some questions. Provide us with a little more detail. That's what the district judge said. Case was then appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and here's what the United States Court of Appeals said for the Fourth Circuit. There's only one court higher. That would be the Supreme Court. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit said, this man was picked up on the field of battle. We can't be distracting our soldiers and other American military personnel who are on the field of battle by having them come to court and answer questions like the district judge wanted them to answer. Once we have Mr. Mobb's affidavit, that's the end of it. This man is not entitled to a hearing. He's not entitled to a trial. He's not entitled to a lawyer or to consult with his lawyer. He's not allowed to offer any evidence, and he's not allowed to ask any questions about the government's evidence. Why? Because national security and military necessity dictate that the court not question what the government is saying. That's the position the United States government has taken with regard to these enemy combatants, and so far it's been upheld by the highest civil court to hear the case. With regard to Mr. Jose Padilla was arrested at the Chicago airport. He's the other enemy combatant who's being held. He was not taken on the field of battle. He was arrested in the United States originally on a material witness warrant on the theory that he might have some evidence as a witness that the government would like to get their hands on. And Padilla then was turned over to the military and is being held as an enemy combatant. His family also got him a lawyer. They filed a habeas corpus action. The district judge in New York who heard the case said, I think he's entitled to at least consult with a lawyer. Let's let him talk to his lawyer, and ordered the government to meet with the defense lawyer to talk about the circumstances under which they could arrange a conference between the lawyer and Mr. Padilla. By the way, Mr. Padilla is charged, well, he's not charged with anything, but what the government says he's doing is bringing a dirty nuclear bomb into the United States with the idea of detonating it in one of our cities. Of course, when he was arrested, he had no nuclear bomb. He had no bomb of any kind. He didn't have any radioactive material. And the government later acknowledged that he didn't even have a plan with regard to what city he was going to detonate a bomb in. But the government says he did talk to al-Qaeda about detonating a nuclear bomb here, and he knows a lot about al-Qaeda, and we want to get that information. So after the district judge ordered the government to let him see his lawyer, the government said, we're not going to do that. And the government has now appealed the matter to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which has not yet ruled on the case. But here's what's so interesting about this case. They filed an affidavit also from this same Michael Mobbs in this case, saying that Mr. Padilla was planning this dirty bomb thing. And after the district judge ordered the government to allow him to see his lawyer, They filed an additional affidavit, this time by Admiral Jacoby, who was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. And Admiral Jacoby explained just why it is that the government doesn't want people in Mr. Padilla's position or Mr. Hamdi's position to have lawyers. And here's the explanation in Admiral Jacoby's affidavit, and that is that in interrogating these people, it's very important to develop the necessary relationship of dependency and trust between the people being interrogated and their interrogators. And, of course, these are tough cookies, according to the government. And so Admiral Jacoby says in his affidavit, sometimes it takes months or even years until you can develop the relationship of dependency and trust, which is sufficient to get them talking. When do you know that you have the relationship of dependency and trust that's sufficient to get them talking? When the person in custody finally accepts the fact that his situation is hopeless. Hopeless. That no one will come to his aid. So, of course, if you let him consult with an attorney, this is what Jacoby says about Padilla, whom he's never met. If you let Mr. Padilla consult with an attorney, he will engage in the fantasy that he might actually, in the United States of America, be able to get a lawyer who might actually be able to take some steps in court to get this man who's not charged with any crime free. And that fantasy on Mr. Padilla's part would destroy our ability to interrogate him. And so he can't talk to a lawyer. Now, we're not making this stuff up. This is in Admiral Jacoby's affidavit that he filed in the court. Most of us constitutional lawyers think that the very reason you let a person consult with lawyers when they're in custody is to interrupt the psychological coercion that the interrogators are employing with that person. Yes. That's what the Miranda case is all about. Now, what's really wrong with this? Once Mr. Mobbs files his affidavit, the government is saying the court can't take a second look at it. Now, we know that they're willing to lie. They lied about locking up 110,000 people. They're lying about a lot of what's going on now. And the people who drafted the United States Constitution knew that this is in the nature of executive officials. This is in the nature of kings and presidents to lie when it's in their interest to do so, to expand their powers beyond what's healthy for the country. And so they created the system of checks and balances and judicial review. One of the most dangerous aspects of what's happening now is that the Bush administration, Attorney General Ashcroft, are unapologetically and unabashedly saying, we are going to do away with separation of powers. We're going to do away with judicial review. We're going to set aside the basic principles of the American constitutional system and say, you must trust us. You must do what we say. You must be afraid of what we say you must be afraid of. And the judges shouldn't get involved. We can't let that happen.
Michael Avery is the upcoming president of the National Lawyers Guild. He spoke at a recent conference at the University of Massachusetts in Boston entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Thanks to Mark Weaver of community radio station WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts for production assistance with that report. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and Reem Kathuda of WPFW. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. And it's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.